Hi, for those who I haven't met, my name is Steve Dixon. I'm a member of the Institute's Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee and convener of the new Disability Working Group. We're privileged this morning to have an expert and experienced panel of speakers to discuss the future of disability income insurance. I would like to briefly introduce our speakers. Briallen Cummings. Briallen is a partner within KPMG's actuarial and financial risk practice. She is a qualified actuary with over 20 years' experience specialising in life insurance and wealth management, and has spent the last 2 years working with companies implementing IFRS 17 across the APAC region. Adrian Rees. Adrian joined APRA in 2004 and supervises the wealth sector entities covered by diversified institutions, the major life insurers, a number of major superannuation trustees, and also life reinsurers. Adrian also chairs APRA's Life Insurance Industry Group. Prior to joining APRA, Adrian worked for ASIC in the private sector in funds management, superannuation, and life and general insurance. Andrew Linfoot. Andrew was appointed head of life operations of the Munich Reinsurance Group in Australasia in 2013. His youthful looks hides his 25 years in pensions, life insurance and life reinsurance businesses, which includes 15 years in a variety of roles in Asia, including starting several reinsurers. Andrew is passionate about driving change in life insurance industry in Australia to enable us to provide sustainable protection, peace of mind and support for those in need. Greg Martin has more than 30 years' experience in life insurance and funds management. He is Clearview's Chief Actuary and Risk Officer. He is the Director of Clearview's two financial advice businesses. Prior to joining Clearview in 2011, he was a partner of KPMG and has held 10 appointed actuary roles. I'll ask each speaker to try to keep their presentations to about 5 minutes, so we've got plenty of time for a strong and robust Q&A. Briallen will commence our presentations.
Good morning. For those of you who don't know, I run the FSC KPMG Experience Investigations, and what I'm going to talk about today is what does the claims experience look like that's sort of going to underpin, I guess, the problem that we all know exists in terms of disability income insurance. The question that I often ask myself is, what does good experience look like? Experience has worsened now for almost a decade, and as 2007 and 2008 disappear off the edge of our experience investigations, and we're investing more and more heavily in terms of claims management initiatives, the question we really need to be asking ourselves is, what experience is actually good now, and when will we have achieved that success? The current experience investigation, industry experience investigation, includes data up to 2013. The standard table, which you can see up there, is highlighted in red as being those are the years that went into the standard table. When I did that standard table, I thought it was actually a really good mix of data in the fact that we had two quite good years and three not so good years. So I thought this will be a standard table, which is quite reflective of experience in the future. Clearly, as an actuary, I need better predictive skills. In 7 years, 2007 to 2013, we moved from claims experience at 88% or so of that table to 132%. I've overlaid the unemployment rate, which is often thought of as being a leading indicator of experience. You can see that we run out of the claims experience in about 2013. The unemployment rate continues to rise. It's fallen a little bit. When you look at the latest RBA, I think, estimate of forecast unemployment had it not moving for another year, so it's going to stay around that level for another year. The continued industry losses also give a strong indication that experience since 2013 has been far from rosy. So the question which everyone wants to know is what's actually happened since 2013. I asked a number of companies to tell me about their experience since 2013. And putting all these sort of generic bits of information together, incidents, it appears to be stable to maybe verging on improved. However, some companies' incidents did worsen. Terminations, no company who spoke to me said that the terminations had improved. It decreased, but on average, between about 10 to 15%, but some companies had decreases much higher than that. So if you put all that together, the estimated claims impact, it's actually kind of hard to know without doing the proper experience investigation, because it all depends upon which sector it worsened, which occupation, how it all combines together. But as a bold guess, I'd say we're looking at a minimum of a 15 to 20% increase in claims costs since 2013. If you kind of put that together, we're now looking at about 50% higher experience than the standard table. So the question we ask ourselves, which I come back to at the start, is what does good look like and what changes do we need to make to our industry to get us back there? So if we say that maybe 2007 and 2008 were just too good to be true, unemployment rate very low, a good economic environment, et cetera, et cetera, so maybe we put that behind us. So if we then look at, you know, 2009, 2010, 2011, that sort of level of experience, that was all about 120, 125% of the standard table in terms of claims cost. So perhaps that's where we should be targeting, to try and move back from the 150% of claims cost to 125% in terms of what good looks like and where we should be targeting our success at. So now that I've delivered all the doom and gloom, I'll hopefully hand over to my colleagues who will have ideas around what sort of changes are necessary to the product in order to deliver success. Because when I look at the claims experience, it's very varied by company in terms of drivers of that worsening condition. But the one thing that's probably universal in terms of that deterioration in terminations is it's sickness and it's probably mental disease. Thank you.
Going to change over. It is just this button, is it? Hello.
There you go.
Is it right? Now. Okay. Thanks, Brolin. I'm going to read from some notes to actually stay to time, because otherwise I'll stand here and talk for half an hour and no one will get a word in. So just bear with me. So, retail IP has been losing money, quite a bit of it now for a while. Rising costs, unhappy life insurers, rising premiums, unhappy customers, and maybe some embarrassed actuaries along the way. There's been a lot of focus on gold-plated terms. There's also been quite a lot of discussion, including the last session, if you were here, around mental health and some of the trends in that. But I'd like to ask whether they're actually some of the big issues or not, and whether, in fact, there's some bigger issues for industry generally, and whether we're, in some of this stuff, trying to pretend that we can go back to yesterday and bring back the horse and cart. Some first, some numbers. Actuarial conference, you always got to have some numbers, don't you? So this is just APRA stats. It just compares the blue line, which is retail IP, and the red line is group salary continuance results. I had to massage the numbers. I think there was one or two large reinsurance arrangements that went through somewhere in the middle of all that. So I made a little adjustment for those. And it looks like retail IP has been on a bit of a slide continuously, and group sales done a bit better. Now, if we actually look, and Michael just had some bars there about what's happened with premiums over the last few years from 2009, and you see the purple bars in particular is the rate of change of the total in-force premium of the group sale market. Obviously, this is total premium, so it's going to be volume plus price changes, but I think you can probably see there's some pretty big spikes, and that would align with anecdotal evidence that the group area was more effective at putting prices up in the last couple of years. If you actually simply adjust for those two, the difference in the premium rate changes, funnily enough, you get a very similar pattern. As I said, there's some hicks and bumps, but very similar. Downward sloping. Clearly, there's some you know, this pattern is obviously consistent with a lot of underlying macro or societal factors affecting both IP, retail and group. So economic, income growth, mental health, medical development trends generally. It's far less suggestive of any idiosyncratic factors that are affecting retail, but not group. So some of the gold-plated terms and some of the other issues that people seem to be concerned about don't seem to be the driver of deterioration. So that's not to say that product terms aren't resulting in some suboptimal claims cost outcome, or that some improvements in some of those things can't get to a, you know, a better value proposition for the product. But we need to be careful that we don't start focusing on some of those things as the driver of change and take our attention a little bit away from the main game. It concerns me that many don't seem to recognise that our industry is really all about these days. The industry is no longer about predictable, ever-improving mortality risk that just sails along oblivious to the rest of the world around it. Just 10 years ago, over 50% of our premium, a little pink bar, related to death cover. So this is new retail risk premium related to death cover. Now it's barely 40%. It could be down to 30% in the next 10 years. I think this reflects the industry's reality. The industry will, rightly, become ever more dominated by living benefits. Living benefits are fundamentally more complex than death benefits. They are subject to more moral hazard risks. They are subject to pricing cycles, medical, social, economic, and these will continue to evolve over time. So I think we just need to be really clear. We're actually dealing with a changing beast these days. It's not mortality risk. Step one in this discussion is to ensure we educate ourselves and our stakeholders of the consequence of this. If we try to pretend we can manage disability risk as if it's mortality risk, we are going to fail. More broadly, some thinking about the IP problem seem to reflect on the tendency to look out the back window, to my mind. I'm thinking here about approach to, you know, other examples more broadly in the industry. I'm thinking here about the approach to things like genetic testing or continuing to see our products in legal terms, you know, that is in terms of the contractual entitlements rather than consumer support, or behaviours such as pursuing increasing use of risk rating factors to be more selective of risks to compete on price without thinking about how this will ultimately, where they've pursued ever, you know, improved rating factors to try and isolate good risks, what they've managed to do in the process is shrink the market and find they have less and less of an offer for the poorer risks, which ultimately end up falling back on the public system. We are in the dynamic and rapidly changing 21st century. That's where our customers are and where the risks we want to insure are. That means continual evolution and change. There's no going back to yesterday. It is all about designing and implementing products for today and tomorrow. Back to income protection. I've had my little soapbox on that. Two well-known aspects of IP. Claims experience is linked to income replacement ratios. There's been studies done a number of times over history. We know that. The higher the ratio, the higher the claims. Claims experience is linked to economic conditions, and it's probably significantly linked to the economic... And economic conditions also probably significantly link to income replacement ratios, i.e. if you have CPI indexation on benefits and you're at 3 or 4 or 5% and your pay is only going up at 2%, your income replacement ratio on the in-force book is going up. You should expect claims to get worse. Many commentators seem to confuse dodging a technical recession in Australia for 26 years as good current economic conditions. For many income earners, employed and self-employed, income growth has been flat for years, and total unemployment, underemployment rather, in the economy is near record highs. Brylan had a graph looking at unemployment. I don't know that unemployment, I know it's used as a proxy. I think underemployment is actually a bigger issue. Compared to the glory days of 2004 to 2008, when China bailed us out of our last IP recession, those of us who have been in the industry for more than 20 years remember what it was like at the end of the 1990s and early 2000s, these are not great conditions. We have a weak economy, low income growth, plus benefit indexation almost certainly means income replacement ratios will be increasing with policy duration in force. the current claims experience should not be a surprise versus the boom times. And that comes back to Brylan's point about what is good. And good is not 2007-2008 time. Beyond these fundamental economic effects, if we increasingly live in a services and knowledge economy, aren't rising mental disability events and impacts inevitable? Isn't this actually a key risk we need to insure? Talk of limiting benefits on mental health or excluding them to really just negates a core reason to ETRA of our product in the 21st century. Further, limitations and exclusions will be seen as life insurers once again losing touch with their customers and avoiding claims. Comorbidity effects actually make, and legal realities also mean that doing some of these exclusions, limitations won't work anyway. We don't need change to avoid claims to shrink our market. We need to change to better meet the more complex and changing needs and expectations of our customers. To my mind, the experience we've seen, this sort of goes back to the points Brolin has made, over the last few years has possibly made more like components along the lines I've got on the screen there. Change in income replacement ratios, what IIR stands for, current economic cycles, and the wrong benchmark to where we started from is what good looks like. And in amongst there, poor management of mental health claims, late intervention and the wrong engagement model has sort of helped along the way as an underlying systemic trend as well. Yep. Want me to go quicker? So what we should be doing? Recognise that IP pricing stability is a pipe dream. Recognise that we are in an economic cycle. This is not the 2004-2008. We should not be cheap at present. More actively reprice through the cycle. We need our market leaders to actually lead on pricing. We need to educate our market and ourselves about the product. We should look at how reinsurance could better help manage the price cycle. We need to get to positioning of the product in the right terms of language, rehabilitation and early intervention. It's not about reducing product terms, indeed it's the potential of adding in some. In some sense, this is all about claims management and customer engagement. We need to get on our bikes with early intervention, getting to the customers early to manage their claims and get them back to health before they become long-term disengaged claimants. We need to get, the PJC even noted this, we need to do this properly in, we'll need some law changes. To do this properly, we'll need some law changes, and we need to get on with the lobbying with that. We have to have a good, long, hard look at our financial underwriting. I do think income replacement ratios and some of these other issues, actually financial underwriting is an issue, and whether we've got too much passive income supporting benefits and whether our maximum sums insured are too much in the basis of indexation. And given the income replacement ratios, where is our data on this? Banks wouldn't be running a portfolio not knowing about their loan-to-value ratios. Apart from that, there's a few other points there. I'll just leave it. Cheers. It's just to wait till they load it, I think.
I want to tell you about my DI product. So my DI product is great. It's great because it matches my needs. You know, I expect to have an income over hopefully many more years, but if I'm unable to work, then this product is going to pay me during that period that I can't work due to illness or injury. That's great. It fits my need perfectly. My product is great because I've got three kids and a wife at home. They're all dependent on that income that I can bring in. So that's great. It gives me peace of mind. It gives me a lot of comfort. My product's great because I know that there is a reasonable possibility that I'm going to suffer a condition, an illness or an accident that will stop me from working for an extended period. If I don't, happy days, that's great. But if I do, this product is going to help me. My product is also great because I'd much rather be healthy than ill, so I have a disincentive to claim. My product is also great because I know that it'll provide benefits when I'm around to experience them. It's a living benefits product. So this is fantastic. I love this product. I think this is the most important insurance product that I have. Now, those are all genuine comments. That's absolutely what I believe. So I wanted to tell you that first. Because unfortunately, the reality is not quite as good as all that. You probably want to know the secret of my product, and I'll tell you, but I'm going to tell you all the other stuff first. Let me come back to that. Because the disability income product that we sell, frankly, is not great. Now, some of my colleagues did a little piece of research. They looked for the worst product that they could find, so I'll admit this isn't the average product. But where we try and cap the benefits at 75% of pre-disability earnings, we add all of these other things onto it that can end up with, in this example, 150% of pre-disability earnings. So through the use of your highest average earnings over the last 3 years, well, that might be more than what you're earning now. Through the use of indexation, which is not just CPI, but it's often the greater of CPI in some nominal amount. Why would we do that? By allowing claimants to work 25% of the week, maybe 10 hours a week, without any reduction in their benefits. Why would we do that? And then a range of other ancillary or booster benefits that can have a very big impact, maybe not over the life of the policy, but certainly over a period of months. Now, I don't disagree with Greg that economic cycles have something to do with the rate of claim as well. But it's clear to me that if we are paying people more to be on claim than we are to return to work, well, that's what they will do. Another bugbear I have, another reason why our disability income product is not great, is I don't think we're telling the customers what's going to happen. Do the customers understand how their premium rates will increase in the future? We might tell them about annual age increases, but then do we tell them about the inflationary increases that they will have above inflation, the superinflationary increases? So they get an increase because of the benefit inflation. But then if we're at the higher of 5 and CPI, well, then there's going to be another increase beyond that. Do they understand that? We're seeing now in the experience that claims costs are increasing. Are we projecting that forward? Are we actually telling the customers that they're on a steepening slope in the future? And for most of the products that I've seen, they're not reaching the profit hurdles that companies would have. And I think we see that in the aggregate results. So if we're going to get the product back to profitability, we're going to have to increase the premium rates even further. Are we telling the customer that? I don't think we are. The other thing that I realised is that the published data that we use can be up to 20 years out of date, and that's even using the most recent study. How do I get that conclusion? Well, the midpoint of this study is in 2011, so that's already 7 years ago. But based on some very quick research that we did on our portfolio, for the policy that you write now, on average, so this is a dollar-weighted average, might take 8 years before there's a claim, and then the midpoint of that claim is another 4 years' time. So the data that we take from midpoint 2011 really only gets into our P&L in 20 years hence. And yet we think we can price this product. So I don't think that makes it great. There's a requirement in the Insurance Contracts Act that we rely on, which is the principle of utmost good faith. It requires that the policyholder tells us enough about the risk so that we can make a good judgment on the nature or the likely experience that we will get from that policyholder and whether we would accept that risk. Yet we get a lot of non-disclosure. There's a lot that we know, there's a lot that we can prove, there's a lot that we know but can't prove, and there's a lot that we suspect and can't prove. So clearly this thing that we're relying on isn't working. And many causes of claim have subjective symptoms, which are very hard to assess fairly and then lead to dispute. So the result, we have a product that's failing insurance principles because we're going well beyond insurable interest. It's difficult to underwrite and manage claims fairly. And the living benefits, which are good, unfortunately, they incentivize behavioral change. And all of this leads to a huge moral hazard, which as good practitioners, you know, we must avoid. The data that we use, I will just say, they're not reliable because they're so old, so out of date. 20 years ago, or 20 years ago from when the claim happens, the products will be completely different. The economic trends are different. The environment, society is different. So what is it? We assume that we can reprice, that that saves us. I'm pretty sure we're not telling the customer that that's what we're doing. How did this arise? Well, you know, we're all smart people. We didn't set out to do this and set out to mess things up. Insurers want to sell product, so they pay commissions to incentivize sales. The regulators want to balance those incentives to make a fair marketplace, so they legislate that people have to follow, the advisors have to follow a best interests duty. The advisors want to comply with that, so they need somebody who can tell them, well, what are the best products? So they follow the ratings that the ratings houses come up with. The ratings houses need to find a way of coming up with those ratings. Frankly, the products are so complex for them so that they can't really make a value-based judgment, so they default to product features. It seems reasonable. And then, of course, the insurers, who want to sell their products, they want to need to be at the top of that list, so they add more features. It's all quite logical. No one set out to mess it up. So my request, let's make DI great again. I'll get a red hat next time and wear that. We need to minimise the moral hazard. And I think that means we have to take out the features that let us go well beyond 75% of pre-disability earnings, or even dial that back to 65% or even 60%. Make it a real incentive for people to get well and get back to work. We have to be able to underwrite fairly and manage our claims fairly. Looks like that's under threat from a number of the different inquiries that have been going on and recommendations that have been made. That's a worry. But if we can do that, then we have a chance of being able to offer on a sustainable basis an affordable product that will be able to reward our shareholders for them putting up capital to take on these risks. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me here. I won't need that because I haven't got any slides. The material you've seen from the co-presenters here is much better than I would have been able to put together, and I think it's given some really good insights. So I wanted today to talk about three things. Firstly, perhaps following on from Andrew, how did we get to this point? Or some observations, at least from APRA's perspective. What could conceivably be done, and what role should APRA play in that solution? Some of you would be aware that APRA has a piece of work underway at the moment on the individual DI business. We've already engaged with the reinsurers, and our findings from that engagement will be published very shortly. The next phase will be to talk to the major primary riders. So I guess we're seeing enough in the market and in the sort of information we've seen earlier today that's, I guess, got us thinking about there needs to be a change here in the dynamic. And today I'll draw on some of the information we've gleaned from the work we've done with reinsurers, and I doubt that any of it's going to be a surprise to you. So in looking at, thinking about where we've gotten to and how that came about, I guess there's probably three things I'd talk about. The first thing is an observation more than anything else, which is that it seems that the most challenging portfolios are the ones that are written in the past, as Andrew alluded to, and indeed a number of them are closed to new business. They were certainly written at a different part of the cycle, and the feedback we've had is that they were very much based around aggressive pricing and also adding benefits and features for the sorts of reasons, again, that previous presenters have talked about. But I guess there was also an aspect there of people trying to gain market share. Whether that was primary writers or reinsurers, I guess we're not quite sure at this point. You may have your own views. We are told that some products in the market today, despite the complexity and the many benefits they offered, are in fact priced at a level that should really apply to a much simpler product that is going to have less of that upside claims risk that Andrew was talking about. And there's also examples we've been told where the interests of insurers and reinsurers through their reinsurance arrangements aren't as well as aligned as they could be. And that's something I think the market needs to think about for the future. The second one, which again is no surprise, really relates to claims. The medical and social trends around a whole range of claims issues. Mental health has been mentioned already. The escalation of benefits saw the widening of definitions and possibly, as we've seen in other parts of the market, that leads to greater uncertainty in the need for interpretation of claims and eligibility, and that can then result over time in the admission of claims that weren't intended originally to be necessarily covered. And finally, again, management of claims hasn't kept pace with the growing complexity of what's needed to get better claims outcomes. And it hasn't kept pace either for insurers nor for policyholders. And I guess I'd have to say that if you heard what we were talking about with the group insurance market a few years back, there's a lot of similarities here. And Greg mentioned the notion of a cycle. There may be a cycle, but there's also a pretty long-term trend here, which is that things seem to be getting worse, and there's no definitive signs yet they're getting better. Our next lot of data is coming out actually next week, and it'll be interesting to see... later this week, it'll be interesting to see what that says. And finally, we've had feedback also that DI is seen as a bit of a loss leader, which can be subsidised by other lines of business, for example, lump sum death cover, and clearly the two are sold together in many cases. Presumably there's a threshold, however, above which the results for individual DI business is not really within the risk appetite or tolerance of insurers. And I guess one of the things we're interested in finding out from the work we're doing is how well defined that is for insurers, and do they actually have a view of what's in their risk tolerance. So what needs to be done? I'm very conscious. I've heard some conversations today around the fact that people have been looking at this issue for a long time, have tried different things, and nothing so far seems to have worked. Pricing and product design clearly is very much at the core of what a lot of people tell us, and we've heard about that today as well. We heard very loudly and clearly from the reinsurers we've talked to that our products overall need to be simplified, and that less complexity and clearer definition should have some benefit. And I guess that's really telling people how to suck eggs, that insurers and reinsurers really need to think about that. And I guess, as Andrew pointed out, and also from the material Greg presented, today's products are tomorrow's legacy. So those changes would also, I think, assist policyholders, because a succession of quite substantial price increases of the levels that Greg pointed out, or the need for big sudden price increases, isn't a good outcome. And I guess we were very vocal about that in the group market. That wasn't a great outcome for members to see those big price spikes that happened. So less complex products that result in less volatility of those pricing, those premiums over time could be a better thing. Regarding claims, I mean, pretty much every insurer and reinsurer tells us they're doing a lot of work on claims, particularly around earlier intervention, a more person-focused process, and also focus on return to work and the benefits that brings. Everyone does agree, it seems, that there aren't enough skilled and experienced claims people to cope with this new environment. And we note that many insurers have brought in consultants and experts to help them. But I'd frankly, from our point of view, we would see very mixed results about the sustainability of those changes. I guess this whole issue of claims skills and claims experience is something we've heard about from industry for a long time. And indeed, we've fed it back to industry as well. And I guess, frankly, if industry is serious about doing something about it, then something significantly different to what's happening today needs to be done. And finally, pricing and cross-subsidy, that's a decision for insurers. We're not a price regulator. But if we see behaviour or pricing that doesn't seem to make sense, we'll challenge that. And there's lots of examples of what we've done in the group market, so it's similar here. And ultimately, I guess, we're also concerned about the systemic issues that might arise, even though individual insurers might be doing things they think are sensible. If there's a systemic impact across the board, we need to deal with that, and I guess that's what really drew our attention to the market. So what role should we play? We've heard some quite interesting comments from industry in this area, plus also some others, that we're the best place to bring out changes to the market. I guess the main reasons seem to be around legacy products that can't be changed, the issues around financial advisors and ratings, and which inevitably seem to favour complex and feature-laden products over simpler ones, and the fact that any first mover is going to really suffer in the marketplace. And some of that's probably true, but I guess, frankly, it doesn't speak well of industry's leadership if it can't move forward from where it is. Industry's facing a lot of challenges, we all know that, and that's probably an understatement. But I think they really need to think about what needs to be done to change the dynamic. We'll be as supportive as we can of sensible proposals and changes. For example, the rehab changes that are being talked about, APRA certainly can see the sense in those, and we would support them. But industry, if it relies on regulators or government to step in to do things that it feels are too hard, it's taking a risk of losing control over the agenda and seeing regulatory or other changes that may not be seen very favourably by industry. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. There were some fascinating and very important presentations. I'd like now to have a question and answer session with the panel. So if you can send your questions through on SMS or put your hand up or walk to a microphone. And we have an early starter. Yes.
Thanks, everyone on the panel. You know, much of virtually everything you said I agree with. But I'd just like to sort of follow on from some of Adrian's findings and then circle back to what Andrew said. So I really like the way Andrew captured the current situation. But I reckon he could have stood up here 5 years ago and made the same presentation. In fact, 10 years ago and made the same presentation. In fact, 20 years ago and made the same presentation. So, you know, do we ever learn? You know, seriously, it's just astounding how this industry doesn't learn. So what's different this time? That's my question for the panel. Why will we not be here in 5 years having the same sort of conversation? What's going to change?
I think he said you first, Adrian.
I'm not sure I can confidently say that we won't be in. That's the issue, I think, that we see is that we've been through this for so long and, you know, there was a massive, I guess, call to arms and action in the group space a few years ago. I guess one of the questions we're pondering is what is it going to take industry to change what it's doing? And if what we're seeing now isn't going to do it, I'm not sure what will. And, you know, I guess there's lots of questions about, you know, public perceptions and social media driving claims and all sorts of things. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think insurers have to seriously think about where the market is heading and whether this product is sustainable for them and for policyholders.
I'd probably disagree with one point, Ian. I think 10 years ago we wouldn't have said we didn't think there was a problem because there was an economic boom and this product was actually making bucks for a few years. So we all thought it was fine. It goes back to Bryland's point. I think we're just in a bit of a fool's paradise thinking that that was normal, and it wasn't. It was abnormal. Some of my disagreements with, you know, Andrew on some of the points is I'm not saying that we couldn't improve products or drop income replacement ratios and drop the overall pricing of the product. Absolutely, you can do that and make it more targeted. I think, though, the thing we just have to get through our heads, though, is this product, it does have an economic linkage. And it's a double barrel because it both is incidence and duration, and so you get sort of like 2-for-1 hit on it. And I think one of the things the industry's just got to get through its head is that it does have that cycle. And it also means for assumptions around whether we're assuming when we're in good times, we should have mean reversion in our assumptions, assume it's going to get worse and not price for good times indefinitely. So it's a bit like the group marketing in the sense of, you know, a few years ago when things were good, actually started projecting the dotted line that's going to improve forever. You just can't do that with this stuff. You actually have to understand it is going to, a cycle's going to go the other way. And a little bit at the moment, you know, maybe, I know it's a hard thing to do, is actually allow for the fact that the economy could actually get better when interest rates finally do get higher than 1.5%. You know, it's a hard thing to do, but, you know, that's where it is. I actually think there's a big role for reinsurance to play in this space. There was a presentation yesterday by three of my colleagues, Ash, Love and Finn. One of their issues was, is there a mechanism in here for reinsurers to help smooth out some of the cycle? Because I actually think one of the biggest issues we've actually had is the sheer break in the economic conditions of Australia, of the pre-GFC boom, mining boom, and everything in this country where people would crawl over broken glass to get to work, is completely different to only 5 years later. And that's pretty extreme. I just don't know what you do about that. We just have to accept that is the world we're in.
Well, I think the economic conditions can be an awful lot worse than we've seen over the last 5 years. And if your hypothesis is correct, Greg, then we're really in for a bad time if that ever happens. I don't disagree that there is a relationship there, absolutely. But the richness of the benefits, I'm convinced, make that even worse than it would have otherwise been had we given people a good incentive to get back to work. I mean, the example from the States is quite useful. And they went through their problem in the 90s. They reformed their industry and environment and have been making profit margins ever since. I think one of the challenges with smoothing mechanisms or indeed with pricing the product itself is that there's such a long lead time that the information only comes back to you 10 or 15 years' time until you get the policies on the books, until you get the claims starting, and then you get them terminating. Because I think, Braulin, as you pointed out, the termination assumptions are quite significant in the profitability of that product line, and obviously we don't see that for decades.
And I think the other thing to be conscious of is it's not just mental health. There's sort of a few questions coming through about mental health. It's very easy to sort of target mental health, but I mean, mental health has definitely, the claims incidence has increased, which means that it does push out the duration. But when you look at cause of claim, the only one that really hasn't shifted is neoplasm cancer. Otherwise, pretty much everything else does look like it's deteriorated slightly. So it's not just the mental health.
The other observation I was just going to make too is even, Andrew, if you want to bring out a product that's, you know, a better product that's more competitively priced, you actually need the rest of the market to be rationally priced in the first place as well.
Absolutely agree. And I think that's where maybe we haven't answered Ian's question. Yeah. There needs to be a step change for us not to be here in 5 years' time.
Because while there's people selling Porsche motor cars for the highest price of a Hyundai, it's pretty hard to sell a Hyundai for a Hyundai price.
I think for me, when I think about it, if you go back to sort of 2007, 2008, we've actually, you know, potentially had a 75% increase in claims costs since then. Premiums have gone up maybe 20, 25%. So there's a huge gap there. The industry is currently trying to bridge that gap with a number of extremely well thought out and very good claims initiatives. But very shortly, if they don't deliver, I guess the other option is you run out of options, because there's only so long the industry can sustain that gap.
Steve, can I ask a sort of a Dorothy Nix question to the audience? How many people think the experience studies are valuable? The next question is harder. Why do they take so long to get done? I'm sure Brian's got an answer to that, but it's a bit rhetorical. But I mean, yeah, if these things really provide valuable insights, the industry's just got to get better at getting them done more efficiently and quickly. You know, Brian pointed out quite accurately the fact that we're dealing with data that's very old, even allowing for the 20-year factor that Andrew talked about. I mean, you know, I'm not sure what else to say about it. It's like...
I'll just defend the industry slightly, which is that the experience investigations were actually probably reasonably up to date until, unfortunately, a lot of the actuarial attention was diverted to introduce logic. And at that point, we have never really recovered from that, as the actuaries kind of took 2 years off to implement logic.
Logic's a little while ago then.
It is. As I said, we've never managed to catch it up again.
So, a slightly different question. How do you feel that sensible product design could overcome the bear hug of ratings and the best interest challenge and, I guess, distribution that favour unsustainable design?
It won't. It won't without some other step that makes the dynamic change with those organisations.
Having said that, Andrew, I think some of the things you talked about, and I totally agree with, around indexation and things like financial underwriting and income replacement ratios, I'm not sure how high they would rate if companies just got a little bit tougher on some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that's the thing too, by the way. I don't think it's just IP. It goes to TPD. It also goes to some trauma products as well. The amount of people who, on very modest incomes, have $1 million traumas and all that sort of stuff is a bit silly, really.
Yeah.
You can still rate high on the rating house, but just say, hey, you know, you don't need $1 million trauma if you're on $200,000.
That's a fair point. That's a
silly you're saying point. So it's up to the industry.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff that we find ourselves in a bit of a mess in around income replacement ratios, and I actually think this is a big issue, and one of the data issues for my mind is nobody's got data on exactly what the income replacement ratio is in their books, that we don't track it, and you sort of go, it's a bit like banks. You said to a bank, oh, have you got data on your loan-to-value ratios? Oh, no, we don't bother with that. Don't bother after day one. You'd be going, you're crazy. We can't actually understand one of the key drivers of our experience is we're not tracking that stuff. I mean, that's one of the data issues I think is just it's hopeless, really, for this product.
Thank you. We've had the final bell, so we'll close. Andrew did want to finish his good disability.
Yes, I told you I had a secret, didn't I?
My secret was when I
bought my policy, I luckily enough had access to a whole research on the whole market, and I had every product listed. So I immediately went to the cheapest and found out that if I took a long waiting period and nevertheless till age 65 and still with benefit indexation, I could get a very inexpensive product that could cover a large portion of my income, no bells and whistles, and it's increased 5% a year in premiums over 14 years, which I'm very pleased with. So that's given me peace of mind, and I just hope I could offer that to more people.
Thank you, Andrew. Please complete the short presenter feedback survey via the app, if you could. And just a little bit of advertising. I'm also, as I mentioned, convener of a disability working group that from the Institute's side is trying to look at these issues. These are really important, so we're looking for volunteers to join us and help us with that work. So please approach myself or Ash with that. And a big thank you to Greg, Andrew, Adrian and Briallen for an insightful but challenging perspective on the future of disability income insurance. Thank you.
Thank you.